think what I realized was that my story wasn't enough. It had to represent something larger. It couldn't just be my sister died, I'm sad. You know, why am I sad? You know, it couldn't just be my sister died, I went to South Sudan, I'm feeling guilty over her death. And I realized that my sister's story wasn't just about her dying and about my grief.
Welcome to Deviate with Rolf Potts. Today is a new Travel Memoir Lab episode, which I remix from the writing classes I teach in Paris each summer. My guest is essayist Angelique Stevens, who was actually a student in my Paris class way back in 2013. Angelique is now an accomplished writer who's had two different essays appear in the Best American Essays, one in 2022 and one in 2023. Though she's not a travel writer in the conventional sense, she says that she does fine wandering, that is, being in places that push the boundaries of comfort, experience, and knowledge, to be essential to her writing about things like race, poverty, and the death of her sister. In this conversation, Angelique and my students talk about the importance of having a community of other writers that you can share your work with. We talk about how to give yourself permission to write about yourself in all your unvarnished specificity. Angelique grew up in poverty in upstate New York in a family with indigenous Haudenosaunee ancestry. We talk about what it's like to be getting started as a writer when you're in your 50s and why this is a perfectly relevant age to break into writing. We talk about the process of taking notes on everything you read and experience in life and how to use the specifics of your own life to write about life in a universal way. One thing I like about Angelique is that when you ask her a question, she answers with a story. She starts by reflecting on what's changed in her writing life in the 10 years since she first took my writing class in Paris. Let's listen in.
I love that it's been 10 years this summer since I've been to Paris, because so much has changed in my writing career. I think first that I call myself a writer. When I arrived in Paris, I was more like I really want to be a writer kind of person, but now I can call myself a writer. I have to say that I was traveling in Southeast Asia the year before I came to Paris. I had done this like 6 week, 2 month. I was doing this tour through, Cambodia and Thailand. I wanted to do Vietnam, but I got very ill. And, I was extraordinarily sick. I thought I was dying. I had like 105 degree fever. I was in this tiny little bed and breakfast in Cambodia or Thailand, and nobody in the world knew where I was. And I was just like, I'm going to die. Nobody's going to know it except this little lady named Apple, who kept checking in on me throughout the night and bringing me her sick soup. And I had thankfully brought some antibiotics and stuff with me, so I started taking them. And 18 hours later, the fever broke. But while I was stuck in that little room for, some period of days, I had just decided I was going to be a travel writer. And I started looking up travel writers online. And, Rolf was the first person that popped up. And so while I was there in Southeast Asia, I had read a lot of what Rolf wrote. And I found that Rolf was doing the Paris class in the next summer. And I signed up immediately. And, back then, it was two things. One, I wanted to be a travel writer. I was inspired by what Rolf was doing. And two, I mean, who doesn't want to spend a summer in Paris? There's this thing about writing. We do it alone in our own space. I do a lot of my writing here at this place, or sitting over there and outdoors or inside, and it's always alone. It's always in my own head with the music on or with it off, with the birds, whatever. But writing is not a solitary practice. What we do is to grieve on universal bones. And so everything we put, what I do, I'm a nonfiction writer. I mean, I've written one or two fiction things, and I have a goal to do a fiction book down the road, but right now I am solidly nonfiction. And though I put the words on paper, when I'm alone, the business of writing requires a community. It requires a community. And I don't think I realized that until really just a couple years ago, that that community is so, so important. Anyway, I started writing some travel stories, and I had gone to South Sudan. I'm on the board of an organization that drills water wells in South Sudan. And I've traveled all over the world. I went to college in Central America, in Costa Rica, and then in Mexico. I lived in Chiapas with the Zapatistas. I went to one of these colleges, these sort of colleges where you don't go to a school, you don't sit in a lecture, you sort of do experiential stuff, and you immerse yourself into the culture in this sort of human rights kind of way. And so my dream was to write about those experiences. I went to South Sudan in 2000. Well, I went to South Sudan a couple of times, but the last time I went, I was gone for a few months. And I had wanted to write this book about my trip to South Sudan and growing up here. And I live in Rochester, New York, you know, as a poverty born brown woman who has had the opportunity to travel all over the world. And in the middle of my MFA, 2016, so 2015 and 2017. In 2016, my sister died. It was a suicide overdose. And so everything changed. I was no longer writing a book about South Sudan and growing up. It was really, it became, everything that I wrote became about my sister. And so now that particular book is a memoir. And it's really sort of an elegy for her. You know, it's also a sort of conversation about why, how it's possible that two people, we're 10 months apart. We grew up just my sister and I and our mother and stepfather, and how it's possible that we could be so insular growing up, and yet by the time we reach our 40s, you know, one of us is a crack addict, you know, who dies of a suicide overdose, prostitute, been in jail. And another one of us is a college professor who's traveled the world and who considers herself a humanitarian. And so much of this book is about reconciling some of those differences and looking back into, you know, into the past. And I feel like I've been writing this book most of my life.
One struggle we have as nonfiction writers is giving ourselves permission to write about ourselves. And for years, I sort of tried to hide my Kansas-ness. You mentioned yourself as a poverty-born brown woman. Was it hard to give yourself permission to write about that aspect of yourself? And how has that changed? Because we all have very specific I characters. And I often talk about how the specificity is what makes a human experience universal. So talk about your relationship with your own identity as someone who calls himself a poverty brown, born brown woman, and how you have come to embrace that person as an I character.
Yeah, I think that was, that's happened just recently. I would say since I started becoming a writer, since I started calling myself a writer, I'm not sure I would have done that earlier. I mean, I think there was a lot of years where I was trying to break away from that particular identity, where I didn't want to have anything to do with it, where I wanted to separate myself from that identity. But in the process of writing about myself, I became something different. And I also, you know, nonfiction writing is a process. You know, I think if you, I can say this only because I've written one fiction thing, but I teach fiction. You know, if you're writing fiction, you get a sense of what the ending is, where the beginning is, and maybe what the essential conflict is, and you sort of fill it in as you're writing. But with nonfiction, it's different. You know, there's something you want to write about. You remember the scene when you were young, you had a conversation with somebody. Or maybe it's just one instance. I remember one instance sitting on the back of my parents' porch eating Reese's Pieces, you know, those Reese's peanut butter cups and reading Richie Rich. That's it. That's all I remember. But I know there's something important about this seen. And I don't know until I start writing it. And then I don't know until somebody reads it and says, well, where are you going with this? Or, you know, I'm seeing a particular theme emerging. Is that what you meant? And through that process of writing, when you get to the end, then you realize where this piece is ending. But I think the process of writing nonfiction is not just about understanding the craft of it, where that arc is, where the stakes are, you know, all the heat, all of those things. But some of it is about just going in. We have to go in. We sort of have to be our own psychologists. We have to be our own. I got to be honest with myself. We have to be the person doing this for our own things. And we have to go through that journey for every piece we write. And I've gone through that journey. I've been going through that journey, one, as I write the book about my sister, the existence that my sister and I lived. But two, as I'm working on this second book about poverty. The second book that I'm currently working on is about the bootstrapping myth, the fact that we can just pick up ourselves and make our lives worth whatever, that we can do it, that if we work hard, we can, you know, we can make anything happen. You know, it's about the myth of that ideal.
You mentioned the craft of it versus going into self. I think the craft can be a little bit more concrete. And so what craft lessons have you carried with you through your journey as a writer, going back to Paris and beyond? What craft lessons stuck with you? I often tell the story of trying to write my first travel book and realizing it wasn't going anywhere, and then trying to write a screenplay and realizing, oh, structure is actually important to stories. Yeah, why don't you talk a bit about that part of your journey as a writer, the craft that has helped you tell stories?
I think the first biggest lesson I ever learned was I was writing this piece, and I think it was right about the time I was at, it was in Paris, actually. It was about traveling in Southeast Asia. It's called Exposure. You know, I had gone on this weekend camera tour in Cambodia. You know, you go see the floating islands and the silk place and whatever, and the guy teaches you how to take pictures. I had an extraordinarily crappy camera, but I wanted to learn how to take pictures. And so I wrote this piece, and that was like, I don't know, close to 3,000 words. And I wanted to get it into a particular publication. I can't remember what that publication was. It was like some kind of big travel publication that I thought would give me, you know, the next piece up, the next step. But they only accepted 1,500 or less. And so I worked on that piece, man, to cut for a long time. I cut as much as I could. I sent it out to my friends. I have a group of writers who I've been writing with for 10 years. I sent it to them. They're professors also. They helped cut the crap out of this piece. We cut every word. I read that piece obsessively. I mean, for hours, reading it again and again, cutting every word, turning larger phrases into something smaller. Every single word I read and cut and read and cut. And I don't know what it is now. Maybe it's 1,700. Maybe it's just above 1,500. I couldn't get it to the 1,500. I could not. I was like, I am done. There's nothing left I can cut from this essay. And man, that was the best exercise I could have done. It taught me so much about writing, about conciseness, about the import of language, about imagery and symbolism, about about the overwhelming choices that we have as writers, and the reason why writing is so hard, because those choices are so huge. All of the subtext, you know, and I realized in the writing of that particular piece that every single word matters. You know, I'm asking every word to do double and triple duty, double duty. And I still feel like, you know, if I go back and read that piece now, I think I've read it in the last couple of years. I still feel like there's nothing else I could cut. I'm sure some of you could read it and be like, oh, you cut that and cut that. But that was a great exercise. Another lesson I got, which was writing the book, and this was in between the time that my agent, we actually tried to sell my book. Let me go back here. I need to tell you this. We tried to sell my book and nobody took it. And, you know, I think maybe there were 7 editors who had read the book, who had read the, you know, the synopsis. And they give you these letters when they tell you why they don't want it. They're really nice. They're lovely. And I was trying to read between the lines in these letters what was wrong with it, what I could change. Really, what we're always asking is, what can I change? How can I make it great? And nobody can ever give you that answer. And they were all sort of like, you know, vague. But one of the things I think I heard underneath when I was being honest with myself was that I had thought originally that my story was enough, that all you had to do was just read what I lived and you'd be like, wow, great story. That's what I believed. But, and I think my agent, the first agent, she was very young, and I think she might have believed that with me. And so in that summer, when I was trying to revise this piece, I was asking her, what do I do? How do I revise it if I don't know what to revise, if I don't know what's going to make this something that editors will take? And she was like, ask another writer. ask your new mentor, who I had gotten this amazing mentor. I read between the lines, and I think what I realized was that my story wasn't enough. It had to represent something larger. It couldn't just be, my sister died, I'm sad. You know, why am I sad? You know, it couldn't just be, my sister died, I went to South Sudan, I'm feeling guilty over her death. And I realized that my sister's story wasn't just about her dying and about my grief. So it's about something much larger. She and I are both, we're mixed Native American. My mother is Italian, so we're Native American, Haudenosaunee and Italian. And I realized in the writing of this book that at the individual level, the story was about us. It was about our lives growing up. But in a larger level, it's about her, the loss of just this loss of my sister. On a larger level, it's a lot about the loss of my family. They're all dead, every one of them. I'm the last one. And they all died because of the way that we lived, you know, alcohol, violence, you know, cigarettes, horrible, all of this. None of them were good deaths either. And so on a larger level, it's about a family who all died very early. But even larger than that, it's about the loss of culture. It's about colonialism and assimilation in this country. It's about these much larger cultural issues connected to the ways that we grew up in this country. And so when I decided to rewrite the book, first it was a travel narrative, South Sudan, then it became this sort of elegy for my sister. And now it has these much larger universal themes. I decided to break it up into 10 parts, and those 10 parts correspond to the Haudenosaunee grieving process. So when somebody dies in Haudenosaunee culture, your sort of spirit stays here in this realm for 10 days. And so the people who are still living take that 10 days, that they put a plate of food out for every day after the ceremony. And then on the 10th day, there's a feast and a celebration. And really, it's about saying goodbye to that life that's now traveling back into Sky World. We come from Sky World. And after we live in this turtle island for a period of time, we go back to Sky World. It's a long journey. They need those days to sort of prepare for it, to build up, to go. The living needs those 10 days to grieve, to get rid of all of that person's belongings. That's all like the individual level, right? The specific things we have to do to say goodbye to the person, get rid of their belongings, thank the people that helped them on their way, but also the larger things, to get rid of the obsessions and the animosities and the guilt and the denials and all of the other emotional baggage that comes with whatever we had in life with that person. And so by the end of the 10 days, grieving is done. The people who are living should go back to the living, and the people who are dead are going back to their life in Sky World. And there's something beautiful about this. There's something extraordinarily beautiful. For me, it's not truly, I don't believe that your life stays here for those 10 days. I'm not even sure I believe in anything after death, but there's this symbolic sense, right? There's this universality to what humans believe and how we can help heal ourselves. And so that's why this book is structured in those 10 parts, because ultimately it's about letting go of this loss, both of my sister, of my family, but of this larger cultural stuff that we both lost growing up in this world. And for me, even though I understood it, like at an intellectual level, the difference between the situation and the story, the reason why we show and don't tell, or, you know, the specifics versus the universal, that ideas, this concrete versus the abstract, even though I understood it at this intellectual level, I really didn't until I had to apply that to my own work, until I had to say, who cares? Gina died. Why should anybody care? You know, what is the larger universal connections? And for me, so much of that has to do with grief and loss in this book.
What I like about talking with you about this, Angelique, is that I ask you a question, you tell a story.
Yeah, of course. That's exactly what we do as writers, right? Everything has to be a story.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. And it makes it really fun to listen to. One more question before I open it up to the students here is, I'm curious about your habits as a reader and how you read as a writer, and how your reading habits inform your writing decisions and your writing world.
You know, not to give away our age, Rolf, but I'm 53. And I feel like I'm a baby in this world right now. I'm just now starting. I'm starting out with these young 20-year-olds, trying to stay young so I can hang with the new writers out there. And I feel like I was going. Well, what was that question again, Rolf?
Reading as a writer, your reading habits, how
yes, writer yes, affects your yes. Reading. And you know, sometimes I think I wish I had done this earlier. I do only because I want that many years to be a writer. The only reason I wish I could have done this earlier was because I want that many years more. I want to stay young because I want at least another 40 years as a writer. But then I think, Could I do what I'm doing now if I did it then? And I'm not sure, because I spent those years, my actual career as a college professor, community college professor, reading literature, like deeply reading literature. And I really don't know if I could be the kind of writer I am without those years of reading. That's not to say everybody needs to be a college professor in order to become a writer, because I don't think anybody does that. But it's helped me, because I've learned how to read literary works in a sort of symbolic way. Now I'm reading works very differently. I'm reading for craft. I'm reading for construction. I'm reading for all of those things. And I realize that when I get to the place where I can't figure out where to go or what to do with this piece or the why, I put it down and I read. I go find an essayist I love, who always inspires me. I read an essay. But one of the things that I've really gotten into doing over the past 10 years, mostly I read fiction as a professor, not much nonfiction at all, except for the few travel writers that I wanted to be like. The last, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years, I've been reading nonfiction, solely nonfiction. Those writers who I want to be like. Those writers who write sort of in the vein of what I'm writing. You know, when you try to sell a book, when you go out there to sell the book, they always want to know who you're writing like. You have to give them your comparison title. I'm a mix between Cheryl Strayed and Jakira Diaz, or, you know, I'm a mix between blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. You have to know where that book is going to fit on the shelf somewhere. And if you know where your book is going to be on that shelf, you should have read everybody on that shelf. I think that for me has been huge.
What questions do we have for Angelique? Adriel immediately went up and said, Adriel, lean in so Angelique can see you and speak loudly.
Okay. Thanks for your presence here. Your tenacity is very inspiring. Two questions. One, who are some of those authors that have been most impactful for you? And two, can you expound on Grieving on Universal Bones? Because that was very intriguing to me.
The list of authors is long. Very long. There's a pile of books in my floor that my partner wants to throw out right now because they're taking over the house. You know, I think I have to say right now, the list of authors, they're all the ones that I've grown up with. Zora Neale Hurston, you know, Toni Morrison, all of those kinds of authors. More recently, I just started in maybe the last 10 years reading contemporary works. I did not read much contemporary works unless they were like genre fiction. Stephen King and Dean Koontz, those thriller kind of things. But more recently, it's been a lot of actually my friends' works. I just, this week, I read Honor by Thriti Omregar, a gorgeous, gorgeous book. You know, I just, my mentor, Wahini Vara, wrote The Immortal King Rao, which is beautiful. The nonfiction stuff, mostly memoirs, like Jakira Diaz or... I don't know what's wrong with my brain right now. Jeanette Walls, some of the older ones like Mary Carr and Jeanette Walls, those are kind of copy titles that I have. Native authors, there's a lot of Native authors now that I've started reading. Melissa Phoebos is pretty top on my list. She's a goddess. She's one of those writers that I want to be like. So I've read everything of hers. And T. Kira Madden, Esme Wajin Wang, lots and lots of fantastic contemporary authors. The other question, Grieving on Universal Bones, that's not mine. That's something a professor said in community college, the same community college that I teach at. He said that great literature grieves on universal bones. And when he said it, it's been however many years since, it's pretty powerful. And I really think it has to do with Vivian Gornick's idea of the situation in the story. When you ask your question about why, what is the importance of this, or why does it matter, when you're trying to locate the central question of your piece, you have to ask yourself, why do those other readers, why should they care about it? What about my story is so universal? I'm a pretty individual person. I'm a brown woman, grew up in Rochester, New York, Haudenosaunee, you know, poor, not too many, you know, those people who aren't me, who didn't grow up there, should be able to relate to my story, whether or not they did. So what is it about this story that will allow others to relate to it? What is it about my individual specific story that allows this larger universality to set in? And I think that is That's a question everybody should ask of every piece that's ever writing. What is that universal theme that this piece touches on?
I'm just curious your writing process. Like, what does a typical day look like for you as a writer? And when you have an idea or an inspiration for a new essay or book, how do you know, like, okay, I'm going to move forward with that?
Yeah. I'm not a very responsible person. You know, I'm not one of those people who can be like, oh, I get up every single morning and every morning I wash my dishes. You know, my dishes sit in the sink until, you know, I don't know, days or whatever. When I write, you know, I teach 5 to 7 classes a semester, and sometimes I don't write for a couple months. I should be revising this proposal. I haven't touched anything in 2 weeks. I sometimes will go months without writing. It's always in my head. I'm always taking notes. I'm always writing stuff down. I always know exactly where the 12,000 little pieces of notes are to get back to when I'm ready, when I have a free day. And when I have a free day, it ends up being 24 hours straight, you know, or 18 hours straight, or, you know, I'll write for 6 hours and I'll obsess over one piece when I really should be working on my book. So I don't necessarily have a writing process. I trust that I'll do it, but I allow myself to do it when it's most, one, convenient, and two, when my brain cannot contain all of the stuff that's been in my head for a few days. So I had that piece in Best American last year. I have another piece coming in Best American this year, 2 years in a row.
Yeah, Angelique.
I'm just like out of my mind. But this piece that's coming out in Best American this fall is about dental care. It's about the vestiges of poverty that even, you know, even as a 53-year-old who has a house and a job, still experiences, which is teeth issues and cockroaches. Anyway, that essay, I got a lot of strange comments on that, the kind of feedback I'd never gotten before. And a lot of that feedback had to do with perceptions of poverty and people who grew up in poverty. And so that for me was the catalyst for writing this new book. And within the space of 2 days, I wrote a proposal. It was done. I wrote it. I sent it off to my agent, and that was 4 months ago. I don't know how long it's going to take me to revise it, but we'll see.
Ryan, do you have a question?
Yeah. Thanks for being here, by the way. You said you take a lot of notes while you're reading, and that's something I'm really interested in. Would you be able to give maybe a concrete example or two of how you do that? Like, do you just scribble in the margins? Do you have like a separate notebook where your reading notes go into? Or how do you do that?
Yeah. Well, I do several things. It depends on where and when I'm reading. If it's a hardcover book, I refuse to write on them because most of the time I get them signed and I don't want them ruined. I often buy papers to write all of paper cover, soft cover to write on. I take notes on my phone. I'm actually working on a piece right now called Notes I Took on My Phone While Writing About My Sister's Suicide Overdose, because I was reading Hanif Abdurraqib's Devil in America last summer, which is brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. If you have not read Hanif Abdurraqib, go buy it right now. But there was so much in that book, I just kept writing these notes about, they were just reminding me about something I needed to write about my sister, something that needs to be included in there, you know, I don't know. And then on the same notepad, don't forget to get cabbage for dinner tonight, you know. And then another line down, when I saw the blood on the floor, there's a description of the blood on the floor where my sister died. And then maybe a couple more lines down, something about roller skating in the park. So sometimes that's how the notes work also. But, you know, as a college professor, I cannot read without a pen in hand. I don't know about you guys, but I'll never, ever read anything without a pen in hand.
And yet, while we have Angelique is being super generous with us. Any final things before we let her go back to finish her memoir?
or maybe go for a long bike ride because it's perfect weather.
Exactly. So, Aaron, we'll give Aaron the last question, but Aaron, lean in so Angela can see you.
I just had a question. Before you decided to devote all of your professional life to basically being a writer, what did you work in previously and professionally, and how did you have writing as a part of your life at that stage?
You know, I went to college. I got to make up my own degree when I did this college, and I the degree that I made up was peace and human rights through writing. That's what I came up with. So I was like all about human rights and whatever, but I also wanted to be a writer. And you know, it's funny, recently I was going through these old boxes where I took all the notes and the diaries because I'm trying to work through this memoir. I found this stapled on the side, this, you know, lined paper, and I wrote on the front of it all about Angie. This is the book I was writing about myself, all about Angie. And I just, whatever, I had written 12 pages of whatever, but I think I knew the point is I knew even then that I wanted to be a writer. I never thought that it was actually, that it could be a reality. I never, ever, ever thought it could be a reality until Paris, until really Paris, until I went to Paris and took the classes and published my first piece, then it started to become a reality.
This has been Deviate with Rolf Potts. More about everything that was just mentioned, including information about the essays of Angelique Stevens and the travel memoir classes I teach in Paris each summer, can be found in the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. And as always, you can contact me with insights or questions at deviate@rolfpotts.com. This episode was produced by Cedar Van Tassel, who also does the theme music. Thanks for listening, and I hope you tune in for future episodes of Deviate with Rolf Potts.